Okay, it's time to take our seats and reconvene. And while we do that, I'm going to ask the door prize folks to draw two door prizes.
Okay, here's $20 from Skagit and Island Counties Council of the Blind. And then, and along with that is a ceramic tea mug with infuser from Rita Dilek, D-I-L-E-K.
Is Rita in the room?
And the person is, I can't get it open. Okay, here we go. Josette, K-E-R-N-A-G-H-A-N. Josette?
Oh, got to pull another one.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, we'll try again. And this one goes to Bob Squires. All right, this is a winner. Holly Turry.
She's eligible.
Yes.
She gets it.
Okay, I will take it over to her right now.
And that's her tag.
Okay.
Are we doing a second one?
And then we'll do one more.
Okay.
We're going to do one more.
Okay.
Yep.
Let's do this one. Okay.
Thank you.
All right. This door prize is Hugs and Kisses from Yakima Valley Council of the Blind, $10 in cash, and Hershey Hugs and Kisses. And along with that is a door prize donated by Lisa and Greg George. It's $5 Starbucks card and Raspberry Swirl Bath Set. All right. Let us see. And this is going to Ken Natz. Oh, I know he's not here. Not here. I know that. Look. This is going to Edward Ricks. Okay, that goes in the already been done.
Enjoy that raspberry swirl bath.
Enjoy.
Okay, thank you very much. All right, may I have your attention, please? It is with great pleasure that I get to introduce to you our keynote speaker for this morning. Her name is Megan Dodd. She is the director of the Center on Vision Loss for the American Foundation for the Blind in Dallas, Texas. Megan.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. I am so pleased to be here and to be able to have this glimpse into what's going on in Washington and with the WCB and everyone here. I have just been so impressed and moved by your engagement in your community and your passion for making a difference for blind and visually impaired individuals. It is truly inspiring. So thank you for what you do, and thank you for letting me be here today and during the conference. So thinking about the theme of the conference, Dream Big, and it reminded me of a quote from Joel Barker, an American businessman and an author. And he says, "Vision without action is merely a dream. Action without vision is just wasting time. But when vision and action come together, it can truly change the world." And so I encourage you today to dream big and to make those dreams a reality. And so the question then is, well, how do we do that? How do we turn our vision, our compelling dream for how things can be different and how we can change our reality? How do we do that, take that, and make it reality? And so there are three behaviors that I'd like to share with you today that that successful individuals and organizations typically will exhibit. And they're not discrete steps, you know, like step one, two, and three. They're really activities that are fluid. And I encourage you to start thinking about these things in your life. And as you become more conscious and aware of when you're doing these behaviors, your ability to make change a reality will start to increase, and you'll see that exponential growth happen. And so these three things are leveraging others and yourself in a really strategic and smart way. They're also having a commitment to growth and constantly evolving. And then the third is to really get clear on what you want and what you want to change. So these are the three behaviors that we're going to talk about today. At an American Foundation for the Blind, we've recently gone through this strategic planning process where we've taken a step back and said, how do we fit in the blind community? And how do we see ourselves impacting the blind experience on a really big scale? Because we are a national organization, we want to have that national impact so that we can change those areas where there are problems and obstacles. We can change that for more than the just one person, right? That change needs to be on a national scale. And so we've identified three main areas that we'd like to focus on, and that's aging and education and employment. And our vision, our dream, if you will, is to create a future of no limits for blind individuals. And that's a really big dream, right? No limits. And a dream like that can have the kind of power and motivation that can propel us to success and achievements that we wouldn't be able to get to unless we had this compelling vision, right? And in these three areas, if we're talking about creating a future of no limits in aging for blind individuals, creating a future of employment with no limits for blind individuals, right? So we have this compelling vision, but we need to do these activities so that we can put that action behind the vision. So if we're talking about leverage, there's really two pieces of that. There's leverage of self, and then there's leverage of others and their expertise. So when we're talking about leveraging ourselves, first we need to know, what do we bring to the table? What are our, as an individual, what skill set do I have? And what are my passions? What am I naturally good at? And how can I leverage that so that I can make a difference for whatever my dream is? There's an interesting study that Gallup conducted over 40 years. It's a longitudinal study where they took these children and they measured their strengths. And then about 20 years later, they measured their strengths again. And then another 20 years, they measured their strengths. And what they found was that the strengths did not change over time. So what you, at about age 5 to 7, what you were naturally inclined to do and what you were naturally interested in really wouldn't change. It would evolve over time, but really those key core areas stayed the same. Right. So why is that important, and why do I bring that up? Many times through our culture and society, we're given this message that you need to be shoring up those weaknesses. Figure out what your weaknesses are and start working on those so that you can be a perfect person, or you can, you know, that you're not bringing others down, right? You're taking care of those weak spots. But if you think about the results of that study, that your strengths and your natural inclinations don't change over time, then instead of focusing on these weak areas, we really should be focusing on our strengths, right? Because we're naturally there already. And so if you're energized by them, you're naturally motivated towards these specific areas, then capitalize on that and exploit them. Because once you've already got the natural inclination, you put the time in, then you become excellent. And so if you know your strengths, capitalize on those, and then find other people that have those natural areas that maybe you're not naturally good at, and then bring them around you. And that really leads into the other piece of leverage, which is leveraging others' skills and expertise. Because as you know, we can't do everything alone, right? When we collaborate together, we do so much more. We have such a greater impact. And so, and I know that this is, the WCB knows this. I was talking with Trina last night, and I'd asked her, what does WCB mean to her? And she talked about the impact that it's had on her life alone, just being able to advocate for herself and having that backup behind her, knowing that there are people that care and have expertise and understanding and know where to point her if she has a problem. And now she has gained expertise, and she knows where to go, right? So when we work together, we're able to leverage so much more. We're able to do so much more. And if you do that in a really smart and strategic way, you're surrounding yourself with people that have understanding beyond what you do. And at AFB, we have been sort of facilitating this 21st Century Agenda on Aging and Vision Loss. And that really is, that's the model. We've invited the community of experts and people that have a stake in Older Blind program. So not only are we having a conversation about what are the issues that face older blind individuals, but also how are we going to make a change and really make a difference. And so I encourage you after this conference to get involved, and you can get involved with the 21st Century Agenda by going to afb.org/aging. So if you're interested in older blind, please do check that out. All right, I'd like to hear that. Great. So that's leverage. And like I said, these are not discrete steps that people are, okay, now we've leveraged our expertise, let's move to the next step. It's really an ongoing process, and they feed into each other. So when we're talking about a commitment to growth, this is really making that mental decision to break down our barriers on how we think things should be and how we think tasks should be accomplished. We've always done it this way, so that's how it has to be, right? When we commit to constantly growing, we're committing to recognizing what we've done well and taking that step back after we've taken an action and said, okay, did that work? Did it not work? How do I adapt, and how do I approach this problem differently in the future if something didn't work? And there's a motivational speaker I like to quote a lot because this resonates with me and my own experience with vision loss. He says, you have to be willing to sacrifice who you are now for who you want to become. And I know when I started losing my vision, there were several times, pivot points, where I had to sacrifice this idea of who I was because I could no longer carry on with that frame of mind. So when I first started losing my vision, I had to sacrifice this idea that, I could just continue without adaptive technology. I could pretend like I didn't have a vision problem. So to move into this place of empowerment, I had to sacrifice that. And so there's this negative connotation with that word, sacrifice. But if you think about shedding the ideas of who you are, how you have to approach a problem, then you're opening the door to making a change. And so committing to growth, committing to continue to evolve and adapt, And really, when you leverage others and you bring experts around you that have different ideas, that really naturally tends to happen. So the third piece, we're talking about clarity. This is really key, but I think that especially for new problems, like what we're talking about with employment and blind individuals, as you all are I'm sure aware, there's a 65% unemployment rate among working age blind individuals. And that's just a staggering statistic that hasn't changed in a long time. And so the question is why? Why is there this ridiculous unemployment rate? And so not only do we have to know where we are, so where are we now and where do we want to go? So right now we're at 65% unemployment rate, but what are the other factors that are contributing to that? You know, is it on the employer side that there's a misunderstanding about what blind individuals are capable of, or how much accommodations cost, or what sort of burden that would be? They're misunderstanding, misconceptions, right? Very likely. And then what about on the employee side? You know, is there the ability to advocate for yourself and to communicate effectively about what your skill sets are and how you bring value to the table? And likely there are many factors on both sides that are contributing to this. But before we can make a difference and make a change, we have to understand those. We really need to know what are the factors. So not only where are we at and getting clear on that, but then where do we want to go? So if in employment our goal is to, let's say we really want to achieve a very lofty goal, let's get the unemployment rate to the national average, so 4.4%. If we say something like that, what about the other factors that are involved there? What kind of jobs are we talking about? Do they have benefits? Are the individuals challenged? Are they competitive? And all of those factors go into it as well. So not only do we have to get clear on where we are, but also where do we want to go? And so when you leverage others, you bring them around the table, and you have that commitment to growth and changing your perspective and getting out of those walls of this is how it has to be, and then you get clear on where you are, where you want to go, that's when you get the action and the movement towards that great massive change that we're talking about and making those big dreams come true. And so Helen Keller has this great quote that I'd like to leave you with, and she says, "The space between your comfort zone and your dream is where life happens." So I encourage you to dream big and make those dreams come true. Thank you.
Thank you, Megan. When somebody starts talking about strengths, my ears perk up, as that is what I do. I would like to, at this time, ask Cindy to come up here to... Oh, Cindy's not ready. Imagine that. Come on, where's my little birdie? All right, let's do a door prize.
Are you ready? All right, I have a door prize, $10 from South Kitsap Council of the Blind, and along with it is some yummy chocolate. And this is going to... Carol. This is going to Carol Gray.
Is she here? Is she in here?
Yes.
That's our Carol.
Okay.
Is Diana here?
Nobody is.
Okay. Are Dayette and Emily, could you come up here, please? Thank you. First of all, I just want to take a moment of personal privilege and thank Megan for pinch hitting last minute. Megan, you did a phenomenal job, and I know your colleagues at AFB who were listening in are proud of how you performed today. You did a great job. Thank you so much. And I have this feeling that she is one of our young, up-and-coming leaders in the blindness community. So very, very pleased that she's here with us. So get to know her. She's here until tomorrow morning. So, yeah. All right. You know, one of the things, the convention committee, we work together to try and come up with a diverse and impactful program for our organization. All of you who come here, take time out of your schedule and also out of your financial resources to be here. And so I think we're hitting home runs so far, and we intend to continue. No pressure. But one of the areas that we felt we haven't touched enough on of late is the education of blind children in our state. So we titled this Education Enlightenment. Let's involve ourselves in the education of students birth through 21 who are blind in our state. We have a two-person panel. I'm going to introduce them now because they both have great titles, and I'm going to read them. So, using Braille, Emily Coleman, Director of Outreach, Washington State School for the Blind, and State Vision Consultant for the Washington Sensory Disabilities Services, and Dayette Snyder, M-E-D. I don't know how do you say that normally. Is it M-Ed, or I don't know, how do you use that little...
Super smart.
I wouldn't worry about
okay.
it.
Okay. She's a smart lady. Extra college. There you go. Dayette Snyder, State Coordinator, Birth through 3, Blind Visual Impairment, Washington State School for the Blind. So I think we have two experts in the field, and I know that they'll enlighten us. So listen up and help me thank them for coming, and then I'm going to let them decide how they want to do things. So, yeah.
And do you want to, you can either use the table mic or you can stand at the podium.
The table mic does work. You're welcome to use that.
Does it work?
It
all
does.
Right.
There.
Cool.
And if you'll just let us know who you are and then go for it.
Oh. Well, my name is Dayette Snyder. I like it pronounced Dayette.
Dayette.
It's Dayette.
I apologize.
No, I actually think that's really pretty.
But Dayette is also pretty. Dayette.
I appreciate
that. So this is Dayette Snyder. Dayette. I will never forget that. Oh. I promise.
It's really an honor for Emily and I to be here today and talk about our really fun adventures with kids and young people who are blind or visually impaired. I get the special treat of working with really adorable babies, toddlers, and almost preschoolers, and especially working with their families in the home so that these brand new parents can start to really learn how to be really great parents to their children who might not see very well. And as you can imagine, it can be a pretty trying experience for that. So we really try to instill a lot of hope and a lot in helping them see the potential in their children. And it really starts at that really, really young age. So that's what I get to do. And I love babies. I mean, how can you go wrong? I think I have the best job in the whole world. Yeah, they're pretty special. One of the things that we're doing at the Washington State School for the Blind in addressing some of the concerns about supports and services for infants, toddlers, and preschoolers and their families in the state is really kind of twofold. The first area that we're really focusing on is identification. So where are these babies? Where do they live? Who are they? What are their needs? How do we support them? that has been a really big goal of mine, is to really identify every single blind or visually impaired infant or toddler in the state. And I feel pretty proud that we're doing a pretty good job, but we've got more work to do for sure. When I started about 3 years ago, there was only about 40 kids that had been identified. And currently we have about 280 kids that we have identified and are actually providing services for. And I actually think that number is an underestimate, because I think there's more out there that are getting specialized services, but I just don't know about it. So I'm really working with the Department of Early Learning, is a state organization that's responsible for early childhood education. You might have heard of it as called DEL. The Department of Early Learning, DEL, has a special agency within it called Early Support for Infants and Toddlers, and it's the state agency that's responsible for early intervention services of children who have disabilities, and that's the agency that I work really, really closely with. You might have heard of it's the initials are ESIT, or I like to call ESIT, or you might have heard the term ESIT, but that's our federally funded early intervention program in the state of Washington. And so I work really, really closely with ESIT to help identify the kids, because some of these kids are already receiving early intervention services. They just might not be receiving specialized early intervention services from a teacher of the visually impaired. We've also renamed that professional of teacher of the visually impaired who works with children birth to three. We call them early intervention visual impairment specialists, because it's really kind of a special, unique job of working with little kids and their families in the home rather than in a school-type system. So we changed the name, and we call ourselves EIVIS. Early Intervention Visual Impairment Specialists. Elvis. It looks like Elvis when you see it written out, so that's okay too. So the second area that we're really working on is, now that we found the kids and we know what their needs are and we know where they live, now let's make sure that all of these kids have access to an Elvis. Or at least some services that can address the special and unique needs of our students due to their visual impairment, because we know that a visual impairment or blindness really affects or impacts all areas of development. And so if we address those unique characteristics really early, then they don't necessarily have to have an impact on overall development later on. So that's our number one goal, is to really give these kids access to supports and services. So right now in the state of Washington, we have 5 teachers of the visually impaired who specialize in just birth to three, so Elvises. We have 5 Elvises around the state, which is really, really exciting. And we just hired a brand new one for the Spokane area just 2 months ago, and that is just awesome. Another thing that we're doing is... So around the state, teachers of the visually impaired not only serve children in schools, but sometimes, depending on where they live, they also might be providing home-based early intervention services for infants and toddlers. And so those teachers, we get together on about a bi-monthly basis for a professional learning community so that they can learn how to bump up their skills to provide family-centered practices in the home, which is very different than school-based services. And so we kind of work together. That's the one beautiful thing about the state of Washington, is we're very collaborative. We work really well together, and we're a team, and we help each other out, and we're all in it together. And that's one of the things that I love about this state, and especially the field of education. I do want to mention one more thing. I mentioned ESIT, Early Support for Infants and Toddlers. They are really supporting our venture to provide these specialized services for infants and toddlers, and has created what we call a practice guide. And it's a guiding document that really helps all of the early intervention program provide the appropriate services. So what are the unique learning needs of our students? And so it helps them understand that. And then also ways to access a teacher of the visually impaired or an EIVIS. And so we're really working really closely with the state Birth to Three program to make that happen. So again, it's a group collaborative effort, and it's again, it's the best job in the whole world. So that's what I do in a nutshell.
Wow. That was so concise. Diet and I tend to drone on and on because we really like our jobs and our students. So I'm Emily Coleman, and as Cindy shared, I am the Director of Outreach at the School for the Blind. Another part of the work that I do is called the State Vision Consultant, and so what that means is that we serve about 300 kids in our outreach program that go to school in their local school districts, but there are over 1,500 in the state. So my role as a consultant is that I'm available to all students to answer questions and provide professional development to teachers and things like that. So when I talk a little bit about the school age highlights, you'll see it covers a lot of ground. But thanks to, of course, a lot of DS work in identifying kids, we're getting more kids identified school age because those kids turn into three-year-olds and then they end up in my ballpark. The cool thing about that is that this is leading to much better services in schools because parents are being educated when their kiddos are young, and then when they transition to school, they can advocate for what their child needs, which we love because we hate to miss a kid until they're five and then find out that they haven't had the services that they need. We have a really, as Diet also shared, we have a really close vision professional community in our state. There's about 85 teachers of the visually impaired. We stay connected through regional meetings and a listserv so that they can reach out to each other and communicate when kids need support or if there's questions about services. So that's definitely a strength. We're continuing to have high expectations for services for our kiddos who are blind. Some of you might know that to produce or teach Braille in the state of Washington, you have to prove Braille competency, which we feel is really important. We're working to build up our professionals in the state, and one of the cool things is we just started a Braille class at the School for the Blind that's online for educators. And we had, it's taught by Mike Seville, who works in our resource center, and we had about 50 people attend on Tuesday, which was crazy. That's awesome. Yeah, it was really great. So, we're getting the word out that kids need competent Braille instructors, and then we're also trying to provide support to make that happen. So we also recognize that there's a need for more professionals in our field. This is not new. We've always been short on teachers of the visually impaired and orientation and mobility specialists. So we're working with universities to build up the amount of teachers in our state. We work closely with Portland State University, and then we also started a cohort with Stephen F. Austin this year, which has 8 candidates in it just from Washington, and we're just trying to crank out quality teachers. And then when you have teachers, they need support. So we've also hired a mentor within our outreach department. Her name is Pam Parker. Some of you may know her. She's from this region. And she is mentoring new teachers, and Diet also helps with that too, so that when we send these people out into the world, we don't scare them by saying, good luck, Godspeed. We try to come in so they can call us. I don't know how to do this assessment, or I have a new student and I'm baffled, and they're not left on their own. So I think that's going to help us retain the awesome teachers that we're able to recruit. We keep adding opportunities for students outside of the school through our collaborative efforts. This is definitely a strength in Washington. The Northwest Association for Blind Athletes provides a lot of recreation opportunities for our kids, and we work with them whenever we can. It's especially important in the rural areas. As many of you guys know, the east side of the state sometimes doesn't have as many opportunities as the west, and they've been great about coming out and seeing our kids over here, too. We also have done a lot of work with the Washington Talking Book and Braille Library for literacy opportunities for kiddos, and I think Danielle will probably speak to that tomorrow. But they've been a great partner for their pen pal programs and some events that they coordinate for our kids. And then, of course, the Department of Services for the Blind offers a lot of great summer opportunities and family support, and we've worked a lot with them, too. So as Megan shared during her keynote, it's that leveraging what you're good at and then seeking outside help when you don't have the infrastructure. And I think we have a lot of different agencies in our state that we meet each other's needs as well, and so that's pretty cool. One of the big things in looking around the room at the variety of technology, I'm sure you'll all agree with me, is that the technology climate is changing every day, and so we're faced with students that are learning one device that may not work in the workforce, or maybe their school districts all use the same kind of technology, but it might not be fully accessible. So we're spending a lot of time focusing on that, and we have we've developed a task force in the state, and Michael McKillop might speak to that some tomorrow, but it's being headed by Sarah Godwin with Washington Sensory Disability Services, and we're having those conversations about making sure there's a standard for implementation of technology. And we also have our tech support who goes out around the state, finds out what kids are using. A lot of them use Chromebooks, and I don't know if you guys have a lot of experience with those, but every time I meet with our tech guy, he shows me something cool that it does that's accessible. And so, you know, 2 years ago, our students would be like, oh, I have a Chromebook, and I'm like, no, you don't want that. But now, Google's really paying attention, and they're starting to meet some of the needs, so that's pretty exciting. And then, of course, we have some short course programs that Jeff Bowler is in charge of at the School for the Blind, which his son. Yeah. Hey. Who doesn't love Jeff? I don't think he's here yet, but make sure to tell him I gave him a shout out. Yeah, you guys did. I said his name. Tit for tat.
He's not coming.
Oh, he's not?
He's a scholarship winner.
Oh, great. Yeah. Great. All right. Well, anyways. Yes. So Jeff actually was working in the outreach department last year, and when he got hired by the school, I tried not to cry, but he's a great teacher. And then we're also continuing to facilitate, you know, meaningful discussions at school meetings to make sure that kids' needs are met, whether in their local school districts or at our state school for the blind. You know, I think you have another person here this weekend, Brooke Richardson, who's one of the great teachers at our school. And I haven't seen her yet, but and so, you know, we always, that's an important placement for some of our kids too. So even though I run the off-campus programs where we're dealing with meeting their needs in their local school districts, we recognize that there's lots of different fits for different kinds of kids. So that's the big 3-21 update. And I think Diet and I were going to hit on some opportunities for growth.
Yep.
Want me to start that?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll start. So I know there's a gavel sitting up here, and I want
to
really bang it.
Give that to
and
me.
I'm not.
Go ahead.
All right.
Oh yeah, you did good.
Yeah. Okay. My need has been met for the next 5 minutes. It might come back.
Nothing else. We're glad
right.
We could do that for you.
All right, thank you. All right, so what are the areas that I struggle with? What are the things I lose sleep over? That's work related. I won't get into my personal life. So identifying kids, as Diet shared, they're doing a lot of that in Birth to Three. In school age, we're missing a lot of kids. And you might say, how can you miss a kid that's blind? Most people can recognize that. It's that we have these two categories that are often overlooked. One of them is students that have a cortical vision impairment. And often that's because they have other medical needs that seem to sort of take precedence. But I think what we all know is that when students are blind, need support to access learning, that's equally as important. So we're spending a lot of time educating schools about that. Another population that we're missing are students, some of our students with low vision. And that's because I hear teachers say, oh, they have enough vision. Well, how do you know? How much is enough? And so schools don't, they just don't recognize always the impact of vision loss on accessing a classroom environment. And our kids are really good fakers sometimes. So, you may have come across that from time to time.
Someone might have been out there.
Yeah, that's right. That's me. Oh, I love it. That's me. Someone owned it. I have a kiddo that I'm actually serving myself right now just because he's a fantastic kid, and I don't get to serve very many kids directly anymore, but he's one of those examples that we've tracked him down now, so we've got to build up his skills. But so we're just continually educating teachers in schools so that they know when to call us. And maybe they don't need our services, but I want to make sure they call if there's a question, and then we take it from there. So that's kind of one of the bigger areas of growth. The other one is, of course, recruitment and retention for staff, which I already shared with you guys. And this has kind of been around forever. I'm not sure it's going to change. I keep saying I don't want to just meet the need, I want to beat the need so that we have good choices about providers. So, oh, you like that. See, I thought that was a good catchphrase. I want to put it on a shirt or something. I'd be the only one wearing it. Okay, I'll let you guys know. I'll keep you posted. I will not do a raffle because I'm scared.
You have an entrepreneurial spirit.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, no kidding. Okay, so, and then the last one that I wanted to talk about a little bit, and Diet might hit on this some more, is improving family and parent activities. Online support seems to be the go-to for families nowadays, Facebook, Pinterest, Twitter, all that stuff. But in-person contact is really important, too. Diet's coordinated some great annual events for young families, and events with our partners have also been helpful, but there's kind of always room to grow. I'm actually the parent of a child that's blind with some additional needs, and so I really understand. I learned to understand his needs through talking to others, being mentored by adults who are blind, and also finding this community. So that's a really important area of growth, I think, for our field. So, and I don't know, Diet might have some things to add. I'm going to hit the gavel. No.
We're educators.
We're
it's what we do.
Friday.
It's Friday. It's what we do.
Well,
there you go. Yeah.
Thank you for making noise. You gave me a target.
Okay. Sure.
Anytime.
Yeah, I really want to touch on the. I'm a big proponent and a big advocate for parent to parent support. I think that Emily and I are, Emily's a parent, so she doesn't really fall into this equation, but. Providers and educator and professionals can offer so much support, but really when that same message is coming from another parent, it's going to have that much more meaning to a parent. So I would really love to create some more opportunities for parents to gather, for parents to meet, for parents to build connections, to create like a group like you guys have. I mean, I think that social connection is so important when you're dealing with sometimes challenges in your life, and you need other people who are dealing with those same challenges to help mentor and guide you through that. I'm actually with you today, and I didn't get to go to the pumpkin patch with our family, so I just want you to know that's how special you guys are. So we have what's called a parent-infant playgroup or PIP program every other Friday at the School for the Blind. And so we do different activities. So we do group activities to the zoo, and we went to the, pumpkin patch. They went to the pumpkin patch today. We had a parent-to-parent workshop this summer, which was our second one, where the topic was expanded core curriculum. And expanded core curriculum and teaching those critical areas really starts as babies. So teaching parents about those concepts, but then also sometimes that's just the vehicle to get parents in the same room together and then let them make those connections. And so part of what I want to do is really kind of create some more of those social connections with parents so that they can start to build a community to support one another. And it doesn't have to come from professionals. And so that's my dream. There you go. That's my dream. Yeah. So we can field questions.
Yeah. If we could get our mic runner. And is anybody, does anybody have a question for either Diette or Emily or both? So do we have the microphone somewhere? Who's running it?
There's a mic.
Okay, we've got.
Okay.
I think Kevin's going to run it. So.
Hi, Diette and Emily. I'm so glad you're here. I was the one that got to call and invite you, and I'm so delighted you could come and share all of your experience with us. And primarily, Diette, I have a question for you. You know, a lot of people say, well, I bet there aren't any blind kids anymore, but there obviously are. Could you tell us either the leading two or three causes of blindness these days?
Oh, boy. That's a great question because I'm in a PhD program and that's my dissertation topic. So how much time do you have? Actually, the three leading causes of blindness in children are very different than causes of blindness in adults. The number one cause in about 60% of all children with visual impairments have a brain-based visual impairment called, like what Emily said, cortical visual impairment or cerebral visual impairment is what they refer to it in Europe, in other countries besides the United States.
The second,
cortical visual impairment, it's a brain-based visual impairment. It's not due to the eyes, it's due to the brain.
Okay.
The leading ocular cause of visual impairment is actually optic nerve hypoplasia, and that is when a child is born with small optic nerve. That is increasing with very high prevalence and is really dominating. That's very, very high. The third leading cause, which is actually decreasing, is retinopathy of prematurity. You might have known it as, what is it, retinofibroplasia. Yeah. That term is not used anymore. They use the term retinopathy of prematurity. Those children, that is decreasing at a wonderful, wonderful rate because they're really creating some nice protocols in NICUs when babies are born early. Very, very, very few babies with ROP will actually be visually impaired. Most of them will have low vision or normal vision. So that is not what we see in our babies, and it's going to be eliminated. So it's kind of been cured, which is kind of exciting.
I'm sorry, could you explain the second one again?
Optic
PA system is really hard to understand.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Not your fault, it just is.
Optic nerve hypoplasia is when a child is born with small optic nerves. So you have the eye, then you have the nerve that travels from the eye to the brain, and sometimes that nerve is small, underdeveloped, or completely missing altogether.
Do you know why?
There are some theories out there by some leading researchers, but there is not, we don't know why. Sorry, that went a little long. Sorry about that.
Hey, Haley, here you go.
Any other questions? Oh, there's lots of questions. Okay.
This is Haley Edick. I'm an early child development major, which with my BA in early child development. And I think that you guys are awesome. Emily, I like your name. Okay, it's my daughter's, so oh well. My question is, do you reach out to child cares? Because some parents don't want to put their kids in preschool, or there's working parents who need to put their children in child care to prepare those child care workers to deal with visual impairment and or ask the right questions at the right times.
Uh,
you're deciding who's going to take it. So that's a tough question because in our we really work mostly within the infrastructure of schools and with my group and then Diet works with the FRCs, which stand for Family Resource Coordinators, to find kids. And so we don't necessarily go out and to like private childcare entities if that's what you're asking. What we have been doing and what Diet's been working more on is trying to get in touch with medical providers so that we get those referrals when kids are getting diagnosed, just in case they don't automatically get connected to services so that we can seek them out if we need to. Does that answer your question, Hannah?
I think so.
And also, there are some pretty robust vision and hearing screenings that occur around the state, and the Washington Sensory Disability Service is a part of that, and I do a lot of training on screening procedures with ECAP programs and Head Start programs. So we're working on getting those people trained to identify if there is a vision concern, but it really starts with identification.
Sarah, here we go.
My name is Sarah Edick, and I just want to comment as somebody who was born into a generation where there wasn't a lot of early childhood education and evaluation of not just blindness but other disabilities, including the blindness. I really appreciate how far that things have come because a lot of my disabilities weren't identified until I was 30 years old, and that's kind of sad, but it's true. And to see children, to hear about children with all these diagnoses, multiple, you know, hear that they're being taken care of, that's good news to me.
You're going to make Diet cry.
My name is Janice Squires, and I have a question and a comment. I'm a mother of two daughters, a blind mother, and my daughter is an early intervention specialist with Children's First Therapy. She's the director, and she knows both of you, Carrie Gibbons, and she absolutely loves you. But, you know, I have a grandson, and, you know, talking about the brain eye, and we never noticed because, you know, you just don't notice because he has 20/20 vision. But when they get in school and start to read, it's that brain isn't working with the eye, so when he reads, he's not tracking. And so, I mean, do you deal... There are so many children in this vision therapy now. It's just, like, amazing how many children are affected. And what's odd is the kindergarten teacher didn't spot it, but, you know, once they start to read, you know, he's having a little trouble, but they're working with, like, exercise and stuff. But do you deal with children with... that type of problem?
This is sort of the new debate in our field, I would say. And the reason that it is because we serve kids that have visual impairments, and it sounds like a visual impairment, but we... where was I? I just totally lost my train of thought. Oh! But we aren't therapists, so we don't improve anyone's vision, and that's where it gets tricky sometimes in schools because sometimes they call us vision therapists, but we're actually teachers, and we provide accommodations and adaptations for students that have acuity loss or field loss. It does get sticky with the brain-based visual impairment like you shared. I think what the difference is that the kiddos that we often see that have cortical vision impairment, they function like a person who is blind. So so although it's brain-based, so we may not get an acuity or a field loss or anything specific like that, they don't use their vision to access their environment. And so sometimes we'll get called in to assess a kiddo like you shared, and just to make sure, because we don't want kids to be missed, and we're always willing to evaluate, but oftentimes those meetings just end in, you know, yes, there's something going on there. It's just not in our wheelhouse to address the kind of vision therapy type stuff that you that you stated.
The therapy is helping tremendously.
Well, and we hear that for sure. They just it's just not something that's offered in schools. Yeah. So sometimes
it's not offered in schools.
No, it's not.
It's very expensive.
It is.
If you refer to it as optometric vision therapy, it's actually a medical treatment. So it's an actual short-term medical therapy that is not educationally based. It's actually a medically clinical based, which is why it is not considered an evidence-based educational practice, and that's why it's not provided in schools.
Thank you.
It was really nice to meet you.
And say hi.
Yeah.
Any more questions? Okay.
I have a comment.
Identify yourself.
The Karen Vandekar, United Blind of the Tri-Cities. The Edith Bischoff Center last year had a beep Easter egg hunt. And it was awesome. We worked with the bomb squad and whatever to make these Easter eggs that beep for kids. The only hurdle that I could see was to, there's certain laws of privacy for those kids that are in school. How do you get a hold of them and encourage them? I know parents have a lot to do with it, but how do you breach that gap?
So, yeah, that's a great question and something that we get asked from time to time, because there's often agencies or groups that want to reach out to our families and we can't share contact information. So I would recommend that you go through your local Teachers of the Visually Impaired or Department of Services for the Blind, and because sometimes they have they usually have kids on their roster too, and then we can help disseminate information if you're holding an event or if you'd like to partner with one of those groups to do something. That's usually what I recommend, because you can't really go directly to families.
Can I piggyback on that and say there's an email list that educators are on, and it's called EVE, and it's a great way for word to get out. So if you can get with just one person that's on that list to share your event,
that would be so you could
email Emily.
Yeah, I do facilitate that listserv. I'm the moderator. So if you want anything to share, you can just email it to Emily,
and she'll share it, and it gets out there. I mean, I see things for Northwest Athletes, and just all kinds of activities going on. DSB does, and so on. So, yeah. Any other questions?
Sue's got another one, it looks like.
Okay. Kevin, do you have your running shoes on?
Yes, ma'am.
So I'm going to just take a point of privilege, because I get to every so often, and just say how heartwarming it is. I worked in Central Kitsap School District with blind students for 20 years as a paraeducator, and so I have at least two students of mine are grown adults now that are here, John Moberg and Michelle Denzer, but even better yet, and no offense, Michelle or John, but Kevin, who's running around, and his wife, Kathy Torcolini, their daughter, Nicole, was also one of my students, who has won scholarship from us in the past, and they came to this convention from Silverdale just to volunteer. So, yeah. Not to embarrass anybody, but there you go.
Thanks, Cindy.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Well, it's Sue again. See, I was going to facilitate this panel, but I let Cindy do it, so now I get to ask questions, right? So I actually have two questions. The first one, and I think you answered this already, but are you able to, or is there an organization who is able to get information to every hospital social worker in this state, so that if they have a little one that's born with a visual impairment, they can be referred to you guys right away? That's my first question, and then I have another one.
Yes.
Oh, thank you. No.
So I'm going to be short and sweet. Yes, Sue, yes.
Yeah, good. Because I know that's something that I think when Dean hired you, didn't he, Diet?
Yes, he did.
I think that was one of the things that he was so excited was to start, you know, grab that parent and kid before they leave the hospital. That's when they need it. The mom and dad are just as scared. They're already scared enough having probably a new baby, but, you know, anytime you have a special needs child, it adds to the challenge. And then would each of you speak briefly, if you want to, about recruiting? And I could see where there would be a lot of potential for blind folks to enter into this field, whether they be a teacher or a paraprofessional. So I wonder if you could speak to that need a little bit.
We're just, you know, we just pass the microphone to each other instead of grabbing it.
It's you. Your turn. Okay, I guess.
Absolutely. You know, we recruit every single day. I feel like I do. I kind of jokingly tell this story when I did a home visit, and this has happened more than twice, but I've done home visits where I'm working with the baby, and there's like a 10-year-old or 12-year-old or 14-year-old sibling, and she seems to take an interest in what I'm doing, and I start selling our field right then because we have a very unique field that people don't know about until they find themselves in here. I'm sure that that's happened to most people in our field, and so we, you know, being at an event like this is an opportunity where all of you understand the needs of our kids, and some of you might have an interest in being an educator, and we welcome those people. So it's just, recruitment is just something that we always do, and, you know, we go into classrooms and we see a paraeducator, and sometimes they're not working in the vision field, but they're exceptional, and so we pull them aside and say, hey, you know, when you get sick of this gig, let me show you what Braille is, or something like that. Yeah. Okay.
I can talk about that. We heard you.
We didn't hear.
In the state of, she wants to know about the actual classes that you need to take and how do you become a professional. Obviously, a paraprofessional or a Brailleist, you know, there's different levels of training or education that you need. In order to be a certified teacher of the visually impaired, you have to have certification as a teacher in the state of Washington and as either a general educator or a special educator, and then you receive other special training that's sometimes a year or more of a program where you get what's called an endorsement to teach children who are blind or visually impaired. So to be an actual educator, there's a lot of training, but a paraprofessional can, I believe, has to only have an AA degree.
Right.
Is that correct?
2 years of college.
2 years of college, and then we would provide what we call in-service training, where you're providing the services, but you're being trained on the job. So you've been given some professional development to bump up your skills. And that's usually done, you know, with your teacher of the visually impaired, who's the teacher of that student, to help you learn about what needs to happen. Because each and every one of our kids are very unique and different. So that makes sense that you would get the on-the-job training to learn what you need to do for that student.
There's also, if I could piggyback, There's two ways. You either have to have 2 years of college or you have to pass an exam. So there's a test that people can pass, and that's for any paraprofessional in our state. And then the other caveat to what Diet said is if you're going to be working with Braille with a student, then you have to become certified, pass the certification exam in our state for that. Or... You can have the
National Library Service Braille competency. I can't remember what do they call it. Is that okay? Braille
called.
Competency. So either of those two things, in addition to meeting the requirement to be a paraprofessional that 2 years or passing the test.
But Portland State University is our regional program, and then also, like Emily mentioned, we have a partnership with Stephen F. Austin University, which is actually in Texas. And that both of those programs are an online program. And both of those programs, as most universities do, and also there's University of Northern Colorado has an online program. Those are fully accessible, and they do have disability resource centers that can assist you with accommodations as needed. So if you are blind or visually impaired and you want to go back to school and get a degree, many universities have the accommodations. They will work with you on whatever accommodations you need in order for you to have access to the materials and complete the coursework. Yeah. Did that answer your question, Sue?
Websites for what? We can't hear you.
She wants to know about websites. So we do have a variety of different websites that you can access to get a variety of different resources. There's the Washington Sensory Disability Service is kind of like the go-to place, and that's www.wsdsonline.org. That Emily's contact and my contact are both on there. You can always go to the WSSB website. And, you know, Google. You can Google anything. That it'll take you to where you need to be. That's what I do.
Cindy, there's another question here.
Okay.
This is Haley Edick again. I just have one quick question. Do you work with Department of Early Learning to ensure that their websites are accessible to those who are visually impaired for certifications as far as, you know, licensure, the little certifications that you can take online? When I was trying to do so, all of the documents were PDFs. Fortunately, when I spoke directly with the person in charge of the program, I asked, can you get these documents to me in Word? And she's like, oh, no, we can't do that easily. And I believe it is an easy process, but do you work with Department of Early Learning in ensuring that their websites are accessible to blind people, or is that out of your ballpark?
That is out of my wheelhouse, unfortunately. That is an ADA requirement that their documents and websites are accessible. Their web design and their curriculum development department should be taking that into account, but that's really outside of what I do.
And Haley, I would say that, and anyone out there, if you run into such an issue as that, we have an advocacy committee that will help you figure out what to do next.
Yeah, an ADA issue, for sure. Yeah.
Thank you so much. There's so many facets, I didn't know which one to go up. So thank you very much.
All right. Any other questions?
Bobby's got one. I'm heading over there.
Okay.
Thank you. I'm Bob Whitlow, and I have a question. It's how are there tests that they run at the hospital for newborns? How do they know? Like when my wife was born a few years ago, her mom noticed that she didn't pick up little things off the floor like most babies do. And so she was an RN, so she took to an ophthalmologist there and Dr. Martha there in Boise, and so they started checking, and how do they know from the hospital that, you know, a newborn has the problem at birth? Yeah.
That's a really, really great question. Simply because, you know, there are federal mandates for newborn hearing screenings, and every child born before you can leave the hospital has to have a hearing screening to make sure that their hearing is okay, which is a wonderful, wonderful program. Unfortunately, that's not possible for vision,
right?
Because all babies are born with an acuity of about 20 over 400. Vision does not develop. It develops gradually over 6 months up to 1 year of life. So it's impossible for us to do a newborn vision screening similar to newborn hearing screenings. However, there are very observable type of things that doctors do. So they look in eyes, they make sure that eyes are clear so that babies aren't born with cataracts. They can test for eye anomalies. So sometimes children are born with no eyes, with small eyes, with large eyes, with abnormal eyes, and that can be seen very, very clearly. Colobomas can be seen very clearly. They do that kind of observational stuff. They have a very, very tight and rigorous protocol for children who are born premature. So any baby born less than 37 weeks, then they always test for retinopathy of prematurity, and they monitor that. So they are doing some tests, but it's impossible for them to test all babies born similar to newborn hearing screenings. That's why it's really important that we get this message out to all parents to do vision screening at 6 months with their pediatricians, so that if problems do arise at that 6 month point, eyes aren't working together, babies aren't tracking, that kind of thing, or being able to use vision the way we would think that they use, with the knowledge of visual development that we do have, that pediatricians are then referring kids to eye specialists as needed. So we have to have some good partnership with our pediatricians, and we're definitely working on that.
Thank you.
That's a great question.
Thank you very much.
I have a question. So when I was a young mom who's blind, that gentleman just talking, his wife, Pat, was a mentor to me because she was a little older than me, and she had children and been there and done that. And this was before Facebook and Twitter and, you know, social media and email. And that was invaluable to me. And I think about how important it is that parents are encouraged, as well as young people, to see successful blind people. And so here's my question to both of you. We have chapters all over the state. What would be something that we could do? I heard the egg hunt. That's one way of, but are there other tangible ways that we could involve ourselves in our community and reach out to families with kids who are blind? That's my first question. Then I have a follow-up.
Yeah, so I think that we would welcome any and all of you at the events that we do have for our kids. Of course, in the Vancouver area, they have a lot going on at the School for the Blind, and they have a lot of volunteers. But when we have events that happen in this part of the state, it would be nice to know if there's anybody that would want to, you could volunteer and come to these events as well and get to meet some of our families and some of our kiddos, and I think that would be great. So if there was people interested in doing that, they could reach out to us. Yeah, or Diet says, or you can have your own events, and then we can help you tell families about it. So.
The question's if there is announcements about when there's events in our given areas.
So, again, it's working with your local providers, because, like, when Diet and I come to town, it's usually to do a technical assistance or a consult or that kind of thing. But your local folks are the ones that are going to be coordinating events for their students. So being in touch with them is probably your best resource.
I mean, it could be as simple as having a family pizza night. So have a family pizza night, have your local pizza parlor donate some pizzas, send us a notice saying, hey, we're having a family pizza night. Can you share this flyer with your families to come to a certain place at a certain time and have family pizza night? And I think that's as simple as it is.
Okay. And then my other question is, I want to do a call to action. So here, we are an organization of the blind, advocating for people who are blind. We had you come here because we wanted to know really what the current climate is for educating children birth to 21. Is there anything this organization, and we believe we have some clout, you know, we have a voice, we're willing to use it, we're willing to make calls, write letters, be present, do whatever. Is there something we could be doing that we're not, that would help you guys do your jobs better and or the field and or especially the education of those kids?
Even legislatively, Cindy.
Pardon? Yeah, whether it's legislatively or otherwise, is there anything that we could be doing? I know. Okay.
You know our boss is in the audience right here?
It's okay. It's okay. No, we're asking you guys because you're in the field. So, empty slate, dream. Dream big. That is our convention. Dream big.
Gosh.
We want you to dream big. We may not be able to do it, but. That's right. Beat the need.
You know, I think one of the things, and legislatively made me think of this, but I'm not sure if all of you are aware of the Cogswell-Macy Act.
Yes.
And so that's a big push right now, federally, legislatively, to get our kids better services and more of what they need. So I know that if you wanted to look into that and ways to contact representatives to support it, that would be a huge win for our kids if that went through. And I don't know, in the state right now, we don't have a vision-specific thing that we're trying to get pushed through, but those come and go. So I'm going to keep you guys posted. And then, again, I think it's just supporting the families and the kids in your regions, attending events, having events. I think that's a huge thing, what Diet said, just by having a pizza night. You know, when my own son was blind, spending a lot of time with adults that were blind and visually impaired made it seem like not that big of a deal. So, and it just made it everything, the horizon was like, there was no end to it. So I think that's a really important thing that this organization has the capability of doing.
All right. Can you all help me thank Emily and Diet for coming today? You exceeded my expectations. You guys were wonderful. Thank you so much. Yeah. Stick around. We'd love to have you here. And I'm going to turn this over to Steve. We're done with questions. Thank you.
No more.
I was standing in the back of the room, and I think I heard a challenge from these two ladies. And I'm going to challenge you, the membership of WCB. You all are well aware that I have been evangelizing the need for younger members and the need to reach out to those. And one way to start is to reach the young. But one way to the hearts of the young is through the hearts of the parents. And we as an organization can be that support network for parents of blind children or parents who are blind. And I know, and I've heard this over and over again, that that's one of the missing links in the chain, is that parents don't know where to turn or to whom to turn to. And sometimes just having that friendly voice to talk to can make a huge difference. So my challenge to you, to us, is to create that social network of parents. So, can we have a door prize and then we will close for lunch?
Who wants money? All right, here we go. $25. Randy Builder. And this is going to Diana Turley.
She's here. Do you have one more? We got time.
Sure. Any more? Here is. Get me ready. Okay. This is $10 from GDUWS. And this is going to. Oh, no. Give me another one. No, but I knew the person isn't here. This is going to Stuart Russell.
Oh, yeah. A little more excitement, Stuart. All right, thank you very much. We will now break for lunch. Lunch will be in the gold silver room. And we will start at noon for the awards luncheon. And then reconvene. What time do we reconvene? We reconvene at 1:30.